Hello and welcome to the Deep Dive Perspective. Scott Richards with me today. We're privileged to have an expert, not only in terms of his background as a United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, a former United Nations Special Commission's weapons inspector, author, commentator. Scott is probably the leading voice in terms of military analysis of what's been going on in West Asia in particular. But I'm going to come at a different angle with Scott today, something others very rarely touch on, but Scott certainly demonstrated a knowledge base, and that's the faith element, the spiritual element within the war, within the axis of resistance, and just how everything's panning out also, given that the Jewish supremacists, Jewish fundamentalists within Israel have been talking about red heifers, they've been talking about the return of the Third Temple, and we've got Mr. Hegseth and others in the American administration committed to Christian Zionism, who also have their own Armageddon, their own eschatological connection to the return of antichrists and the return of all sorts of other messiahs. Well, this is an element that fascinates me. And Scott, thank you so much for taking up the challenge.
Well, thanks for having me. I hope I'm up to the task.
Yeah. I mean, war is a serious business, and we will get on to the other aspects of what's been going on since we last had you on the show. So much has happened. But let's start with this, because the axis of resistance is rooted in the history of Imam Hussein al-Islam, the resistance against an imperialist called Yazid, which is something which many people will still not know about. But actually, the resistance is very much rooted in this ideology of taking on empires, taking on oppressors. You know, these themes are there. Where did you come across these themes in your practical work in the field? And what did you think of them? And where are you now with your ideas around this?
Well, I mean, when I first became an intelligence officer in the Marines, I was assigned to the 7th Marine Amphibious Brigade, which was the Marine component of the Rapid Deployment Force. And at that time in the mid-1980s, we had our go bags, the sea bags, basically our duffel bags with, all the things we needed to deploy within an hour, all packed and ready to fly off to the Middle East, where we were tasked with implementing various operational plans that dealt with the Iran-Iraq war. And, one of the things that we were focused on was, the fighting around Fish Lake, which was north of Basra, where the Iranians were threatening to break through, and what would happen if they did break through, and if they did isolate Basra, how we would respond to such a scenario. You know, there's the old maxim, know your enemies, you know yourself. And therefore, in preparing to fight the Iranian enemy, I wanted to study what motivated them. One of our main goals and objectives was suppression of command and control by eliminating the ability of leadership to communicate effectively with the soldiers. The idea would be to break the will of the soldiers to continue to resist. We saw the Iranians do this very effectively with the Iraqis, where, even Republican Guard units, when their leadership was unable to directly communicate with Iraqi soldiers, the Iraqi soldiers tended to lose confidence and retreat. And so the question I asked myself is, would the same tactic apply to the Iranians? Would we be able to achieve the same kind of result? And the answer was maybe, but not absolutely certain. And one of the reasons is because of the faith, the deep faith that Iran brought to the battlefield, the faith of Shia Twelverism, this notion that Iran was fighting a just war, not your standard jihad, but a holy war in defense of the principles of the Shia faith. Again, I looked in a. Remember, I was a lieutenant at the time. I wasn't a PhD scholar, so I don't claim to, to gone through the definitive source material. But sure. I familiarized myself with, the Battle of Karbala. What happened to, from Ali to Hassan to Hussein to Hassan, or Hassan to Hussein, I believe. In this notion of, being willing to make the ultimate sacrifice in defense of a just cause against an oppressor. And so that's the foundation of, how I dipped my toes into, the concepts that involve the Shia faith.
And how effective was that kind of psyche or ideology within the soldiers at that time that you were dealing with? How effective was that in the battlefield? Did it make a difference?
Well, from my perspective, it did. It didn't matter because we never did deploy at that time to fight an Iranian threat. But in studying the Iranians, what we could see is that you basically had to kill them in order to get them to stop fighting. It was very rare that the Iranians broke and ran at the front. The Iraqis would do large scale withdrawals. That doesn't mean the Iranians were immune to it. We know in Al-Faw, for instance, when the Iraqis deployed chemical weapons, that this was demoralizing for the Iranians because they just had no ability to deal with it. And a human being is a human being when confronted with this kind of terrifying imminent death. But, the Iranians pressed forward their attacks beyond the level in which you would expect a Western counterpart to do so. They would be willing to take more casualties, a higher casualty rate, and continue the mission than, in the West. So I do believe that faith played a very important role in the combat efficiency of the Iranian forces.
Well, the truth is that fast forward to now, we know that the current conflict, the backdrop to it, in a way, was spinning off another strand of Muslim, if you like, ideological militancy, and that was ISIS. And of course, there's a strong whiff of ISIS being an asset, an entire operation for the Western imperialist system. Yet, when they came head to head with the Iraqi forces in Iraq and General Soleimani and those who were fighting them, that was another interesting aspect of how the intra-religious clash and the ideologies and the religious motivations on both sides were impacting the war. Did you follow much of that?
Well, what I would note is that the as the war progressed, Saddam Hussein began to become less and less secular and more religious. And what's interesting is that he invoked a lot of Shia faith. A large number of the Iraqi soldiers that fought in the Iraqi army were Shia. Sure. So it wasn't necessarily a Sunni Shia conflict. It was Arab versus Persian conflict, which is the way that the Iraqi government liked to play it. But the Iraqi military, the military professionals weren't radical Sunni Islamists. They were, secular Muslims who put, their professional ideals above, religious fanaticism. Unlike many on the Iranian side, especially in the Revolutionary Guard, who were very deeply religious and wore the religion on their sleeve. So I can't say that this was a Sunni Shia fight from my perspective. Again, I don't claim to be, possessing the totality of knowledge available, but, based upon not only the work I did as a Marine intelligence officer, but later as a weapons inspector in Iraq for 7 years, working with the Iraqi armed forces to try and find out not only what happened to weapons of mass destruction, but why they felt compelled to produce ballistic missiles, why they felt compelled to acquire chemical weapons, biological agent, and even pursue a nuclear bomb. Much of it was driven by their concerns over, the threat posed by Iran. And so when discussing this, I got an insight into how they perceived Iran, and it wasn't perceived through the prism of religious ideology. It was perceived through a prism of a secular warrior preparing to fight a more religious, a religiously fanatic enemy.
And that sort of starts to change slightly, I think, because when Saddam's demise finally occurs and Iraq is kind of liberated in a sort of way, and the Americans still around, but the Iranians have started to sort of also move in into Iraq. And of course, Iraq is the heartland. That's where Karbala is. That's where Imam Hussein's martyrdom took place. And indeed, those Iraqis who particularly live down in the south have got a very strong Shiite ideology, and they too are motivated. And when it came to the triggering of ISIS, when they tried to form their caliphate across Iraq, it was very much Ayatollah Sistani's religious call or fatwa for jihad against these ISIS fighters, who would call them, they call themselves Muslims as well. They were called Takfiris now generally. But it was Ayatollah Sistani invoking the jihad, and that's when the Iraqi, largely Shia militias, PMUs, they came on the scene. Do you see that there's a definite shift in terms of the way that the Iraqi troops now organize themselves?
Well, yeah, I mean, we can, again, look back to some of the hard fighting that took place in 1991 after the end of Desert Storm, when you know, the United States tragically encouraged a Shia uprising. At that time, you know, the Iranian forces, they were organized something called the Badr Brigades, or, you know, Badr. Mm. And they were, you know, seeking to gain access to, you know, Shia communities in the south. And this was a constant struggle. I remember as a weapons inspector, when we go to certain places in the south, that we had to be closely escorted by Iraqi soldiers. And as the sun went down, we had to get the heck off the highway and into a safe haven, because the night belonged to Shia insurgents. And this was the case in 92, 93, 94. So there was always this Shia-Sunni aspect of it. What was interesting, too, is as time went on, you would notice, for instance, in areas like Fallujah and out in Anbar, that there were increased Sunni issues, you know, with Sunni you know, jihadists forming up against Saddam Hussein, organizing against it. I remember watching, you know, Iraqi special operations operate against cells in and around Fallujah. And what we found out through inspections, because our inspections were all encompassing, we were looking for hidden weaponry, but we're also looking for organizations capable of hiding these. And so I investigated the totality of the Iraqi security infrastructure, Amin al-Alam, the Amin al-Khas, the Special Security Organization, the Special Republican Guards, the Intelligence Mukhabarat, Istakhbarat, everything. And in order to confirm that they weren't doing what we feared they were, we had to examine a lot of documents. And I was exposed to the fact that the Iraqi government had made a concerted effort to infiltrate both Sunni extremists and Shia extremists with long-term stay-behind agents. And when the war ended, when the 2003 invasion ended, one of the last orders that Saddam gave to these units was to stay behind and be, you know, embed yourself into these organizations, to include actually fighting until the time came when you were given certain instructions. So what you're calling ISIS going up against the Shia, in many cases, these ISIS units were, you know, coming from villages and areas in Western Iraq that had significant a high proportion of their sons serving in the Special Republican Guard units. And now they've reconfigured themselves as, you know, ISIS. If you look when ISIS made their move on Mosul, then down towards Tikrit, how quickly you know, pro-Saddam elements in the Tikrit area aligned themselves with ISIS, because there was long-standing linkage between the security services that were the heart of you know, the stay behind pro Saddam forces and these Sunni insurrectionists. So when in many ways, when Sistani mobilized the popular militias, He wasn't just mobilizing against, you know, ISIS. It was actually a continuation of the struggle against Saddam's regime.
Fascinating stuff. It's, of course, a bit of history which people don't know much about. So I'm not going to apologize for us going that direction. But let's try and bring it a little bit more to the motivations which actually drive the axis of resistance, because that brings in the PMU. We've talked about the Iranian armed forces there, but it's also the same scenario out in Lebanon with Hezbollah, who are very much in the at the center of the entire conflict now. I mean, it all hinges on what Israel's attitude towards Hezbollah is going to be. But Hezbollah were probably the quintessential fighting force which had a hardcore Karbalai Husseini ideology driving them. Do you know much about that development of Hezbollah from that perspective?
Well, I know a little bit because, again, there's a heavy Iranian influence there. You know, when you take a look at the Shia faithful of southern Lebanon, many of the imams are schooled not from Najaf and Sistani's, school of thought, but actually come from Iran. And so there was a lot of inherent sympathy or empathy for the Iranian perspective. And so when the revolution took place and Viliadi Faqih became the dominant ideology of Iran, the jurisprudence of the supreme leader, southern Lebanon fell into that. And so you had, a school of thought in southern Lebanon that was aligned with the Iranian supreme jurisprudence. So they took their spiritual guidance not from Najaf or Sistani. They took their spiritual guidance from Iran. And so as when the Israelis invaded, you know, what was interesting is that Hezbollah didn't exist at the time. In fact, the Shia militia, I think, was primarily Amal militia, which wasn't necessarily composed of Shia who were theologically aligned to the Qom, but many Shia who were aligned with Sistani. It wasn't as black and white as Hezbollah morphed into this. And initially, Amal was almost sympathetic to the Israeli incursion because it freed people of southern Lebanon from the tyranny of the Palestinian Liberation Organization.
Sure.
The PLO is a Sunni dominated institution that sustained the notion of the Shia being the religious inferiors to them. And so when the Israelis came in and evicted the PLO, there was a period of time where the Shia were actually grateful for this, because they felt that for the first time in a long time, they were free. But then when the reality of the Israeli occupation became apparent and the Israelis created the SLA, the Southern Liberation Army, I think it was, which was a Sunni dominated force imposed over the Shia, this began Amal's resistance, and Amal wasn't as effective as it needed to be. And there were many Shia who felt that they needed to be more effective. And this branch of Amal became Hezbollah and morphed into it. And the Iranians now were supporting it because these were their religious their co-faithful, their co-believers. And so, the Iranians were there from the start. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard was heavily intermarried into southern Lebanese villages. So when these villages were under attack, they were attacking family. And you saw a lot of Iranians come to Lebanon to support family members. It wasn't just a faith issue. But there's always been a very strong link between Hezbollah and Iran.
Mm. Well, I'm going to broaden it out now. We could go on to the Yemenis, but that's probably gives us a hint of how this strand or this strain of spiritual commitment to Karbala, to Imam Hussein, the spirit of sacrifice, it seems to run consistently through all of these. And the Yemeni Ansarullah are no different, although they're not 12ers, but as Zaydiya, they also have the same strand. Do you want to say a little bit about their evolution in that regard as a resistance?
Again, Yemen was not my primary focus. It's only recently that I've become I would say, superficially knowledgeable of their brand of faith. I do know that for some time that they were viewed as schismatic by you know, the Iranian faithful, that their brand of Shia faith was deemed to be inconsistent with the mainstream Iranian. And it's only recently that you know, fatwas have been issued that have overcome this religious difference. But the idea that the Yemeni and the Iranians were natural born allies is not the case, actually. When you get into, you know, the serious practice of 12-er Shiism, the some of the more conservative you know, Ayatollahs, you know, view the faith being practiced by Yemen as schismatic, as an aberration.
Fascinating.
So, you know, I'll leave it at that. I don't have to go too much.
It is, you've given us a whirlwind tour, which kind of sets the scene for those who know nothing about this. But what the real issues that come through, the commonalities, is, you know, there's this idea of a cosmic struggle, Scott, which is very heavily linked, and it does bring the Jewish supremacists and the Christian supremacists into the equation. And yet, within the Shia philosophy of from Karbala, there's a historical necessity to stand against oppressors, and it's framed in the conflict of an eternal cosmic struggle, which is more than just localized. Now it's become like a geopolitical reality across that region, and it's something which, in a way, yesterday, I mean, I had Gilad Atzmon in the studio, and he was talking about saying that Zionism actually is a misnomer, which is created by the Jews outside of Israel. His argument was that actually Zionism achieved its goal, and once it achieved its goal, what started happening was this Israeliness and this kind of Jewish supremacy started to take root, and that became the objective. And even people like Ben-Gurion said that, look, I'm an Israeli and I'm a Jew. They weren't talking about Zionism. And today, the political parties in Israel also don't really reference Zionism as their core thing. They're all talking about a Jewish state, and they're talking about a Jewish future. And there's also, of course, at the extreme end, with the likes of Ben-Gavir, the really extreme end, they want to blow up Al-Aqsa, and they want to turn it into a full-on spiritual thing. Now, that sounds to me like a massive issue if things like that are brought out, and all of these forces, these military forces, have their political objectives, but they have their economic objectives. But there's a spiritual element which adds a huge load of fuel to the fire, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to the Shia faithful. You know, Ahmadinejad, when he was elected, he is a proponent of a branch of 12-er Shiism that it openly advocates for the return of the Mahdi. You know, the basically, you know, the return of the true imam of the faith that you know, went into hiding after the events of Karbala, etc. You know, and Ahmadinejad was actually suppressed in terms of his faith because the mainstream Iranian theologists and government understood that you can't build a society that's constantly at war, and that you know, you can't sit there and say, well, we're going to openly advocate for continued struggle, because only through continual struggle will the conditions be ripe for the Mahdi to return. You know, rational, and I apologize for the use of the word, but rational people don't believe in, you know, permanent war. Look at Israel. You know, when I was working with the Israelis back in the 1990s, you know, their rallying call wasn't to slaughter a red heifer at you know, at the temple. It was Masada, the Masada complex, the idea that you had to come together to defend yourself from outside oppression. That was sort of the driving ideological force. I do remember a conversation I had with a senior Israeli colonel who was responsible for doing strategic threat assessments, and when he talked about the threats going forward, this is after we had successfully disarmed Iraq, because Iraq was the number one threat for them right after the Gulf War because of weapons of mass destruction, et cetera. But once the weapons inspections, at least from the perspective of Israel, had contained Saddam, you know, they dropped it down. And so I was surprised. I said, how do you rate the number one threat? And I thought Iran would become the number one threat. He said, no, the number one threat to Israel is extreme, Jewish fanaticism, extreme Orthodox Jews who are going to bring in a whole different perspective. And they were being empowered by the immigration of, lots of Slavic Jews out of Poland or out of Ukraine and Russia who came to Israel, not understanding that to survive, Israel had to learn how to peacefully coexist with the Palestinians. These people came in with the mindset that they were going to suppress the Palestinians. In order to do that, they need to talk about the revival of greater Israel. And, this requires the return of the Messiah, not the Mahdi, but the Messiah.
Right.
And that they need to create to make the preparations for, the resurrection of the temple. You know, Israel doesn't have a constitution. One of the reasons why it doesn't have a constitution is that the state of Israel actually can't exist biblically until the Messiah has returned and the temple has been reconstructed. And so, Israel plays this game. But today Israel has been captured by extremists who invoke, this new kind of, the Jewish, religious philosophy that isn't based upon Masada and survival, but rather based upon, the return of the Messiah and the resurrection of the temple and bringing back Israel, sort of an end of days type scenario, which feeds in well with, Christian Zionists who embrace, the book of Revelations and Armageddon scenarios. When, I can say I have a lot of sympathy for any Iranian who is hesitant about Ahmadinejad's, extreme beliefs, because I too am hesitant when I have a Secretary of War, who openly advocates, for religious beliefs that, hinge on, the end of days. And I'm like, wait a minute. So you're a man who believes that the future of my grandchildren will be defined by your desire to bring about the end of days. I'd like a world where my grandchild could be raised in peace and harmony. And I'm also struck by anybody of faith who believes that the actions of man supersedes the dominance of God. If you're religion and you believe in God, then you believe that God has a vision, God has a plan, and that plan will be executed based upon God's timeline, not our timeline. So I'm always a little concerned with people of faith who say, hey, if we do this, we can accelerate God's will to achieve Armageddon or the return of the Messiah or the return of the Mahdi.
Well, you got people like Peter Thiel. You got people like Peter Thiel who are atheists who are pushing that line as well. So it's not restricted to people of faith, but these kind of people who've got that idea of we need to do something to trigger Armageddon, Palantir and all these kinds of very powerful units, they're involved in these kinds of thinking. What do you think of that?
Again, I think anybody who believes that, well, first of all, you have to question some of these people about their true faith. For instance, Ted Cruz, I question his true faith because it's a perversion of what religion should be, especially what Christianity should be. Mm. It's a hate-filled religion. I don't claim to be the most, the expert person on the Islamic faith. And I certainly know that, there are, aspects of Islam that have been corrupted by terrorism and such, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, et cetera, Boko Haram in Africa. But the most peaceful people I've ever met are faithful, are people of the Islamic faith who truly believe in peace. And many of them are Shia, Alawites also, and some Sunni. I can't say that, they're, immune to the concept of peace, but the Islamic faith is not what the West pretends it to be, a faith of conflict and war and conquest. It's a faith of peace. Mm. And so, they also believe in, you know, God's will. I mean, God is all powerful, and man is here to, you know, live a life in accordance with, you know, God's will. But the idea that man can suddenly take control of God and make God do what God may not want to do in order to achieve an outcome that is desirable to man, it means you're not religious when you think this way. You're not. You're using religion for your own political motives. And this is what I think happens a lot in religious extreme. Ben Gavir is not a religious man, not at all. He doesn't believe, the Talmud is not the Torah. People need to understand that. Yeah. It's a completely different set. And yet that, you know, it Talmudic, teachings tend to drive a lot of this fanaticism in Israel today. You're not Jewish. You're not, of faith if you believe in this stuff, because again, that means that you're doing that which the Bible says you can't do. You're erecting false idols in your mind. You're creating something that isn't God. You're manufacturing a false identity of God, and you're making God subordinate to the will of man. That's the thing I try to tell all the Christian Zionists is, you guys say that you're Christians. You believe in, you know, Jesus Christ, and you believe in, you know, the all knowing, all seeing, all powerful image of a singular, you know, God. And yet you somehow believe that you, man, can create conditions on earth that will compel God to take action. That means that you're more powerful than God. And that's the problem with all of these people.
That really sets a kind of a very interesting context for my next, and probably coming to the final questions on this theme. You know, of course, Imam Hussein al-Islam and the Karbala tragedy are all about a man who's oppressed and a small force, literally not more than 100 or so people, and up against an army of thousands, tens of thousands, it said. So it wasn't a military battle. Clearly, he wasn't going to win, short of a divine intervention, presumably. So he did this for some other reason, the idea of leaving behind a message of oppressor and oppressed. Now, that's a very powerful tool in the modern era, where now Iran itself sees itself as being bludgeoned by Western imperialism, being hemmed in, surrounded by US bases, and now all the war that we see, it taps in very, very nicely to their narrative of saying, look, we're actually, it's a sacred defense of our sovereignty, of our rights, of our religion, and that in itself becomes a fuel. Now, what worries me is that in the calculations of Donald Trump and all those people who went for these with the hawks in terms of the latest wars, the 12-day war, the 100-day war, which is ongoing in a way as well, did they not make this calculation from their experiences that yourselves had accumulated during those early years in the Gulf War and afterwards, that you're up against a force which is willing to go all the way, and martyrdom is at its core. And if you're going to try and send in American troops, you're going to try and send in Israeli troops, the result will go very badly for you, given that you're up against people who just simply won't bend the knee.
Well, when martyrdom is the core of your, again, and I apologize because I'm going to say things that aren't theologically correct.
Sure, have the no problem.
30 years of theological training, but when martyrdom is a core value of your religious beliefs, meaning that, you know, you look at the Battle of Karbala and you look at the sacrifice made, it was made for a number of reasons. It was made to defend family, a shielding action so people could escape. It was meant to serve as the ultimate symbol of sacrifice and of the oppressed resisting the oppressors. But, you know, when you look at the Shia faith and the fact that these people believe this, they believe that martyrdom, and I'm not talking about suicide bomber kind of martyrdom, I'm talking about fighting for your faith, defending your faith, fighting against the oppressors, good versus evil. If that's their core value, really the last thing you want to do is push them into a corner where they're compelled to act out on the very, you know, foundation of their faith. The idea in war, as I said early on, is to get the enemy to break. you know, very rarely in modern war do battles go to the bitter end where everybody dies on one side. Generally speaking, if you can achieve a certain dominance, if you can break command and control confidence, etc., the other side will collapse and surrender. And what you really want to do is process prisoners and not be killing people. This is what we did successfully in the Gulf War against the Iraqi army, the first Gulf War. And so with Iran, the last thing you want to do is make this about faith, because if you do that, you're playing to their strength, their moral strength. The thing is, in order to do this, you have to understand the region. And the American government isn't about understanding regions. If it was, we wouldn't have half the policies we had today, because we'd understand how our policies are inherently incompatible with the goals and objectives of the people that we're trying to impose our policies on. We have entire academic institutions here in the United States that exist not to teach fundamental facts about a region, but rather to instruct people on how the government wants you to see the region. We do this in the Middle East. We do this with Russia. We do this with elsewhere. You know, this is derived from sort of an idea that came into being. It started with the Clinton administration, but it reached maturity under George W. Bush, that, we don't have to deal with facts. That America is so powerful that we can make our own facts.
Yeah.
That we will impose a factual reality upon you. And this means that you're no longer a prisoner of history. You're no longer a prisoner of what actually happened. That if you feel that you're powerful enough, you can create your own fantasy world and impose it on people. And this is what the United States has been seeking to do over and over and over again. And in the case of Iran, we tried to do that again. I mean, the notion that we could kill or have killed on our behalf Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, and that Iran would collapse as a society is a fundamentally flawed notion with no basis in reality whatsoever. And yet, this was the central driving tenet of the fact-based, mission that if we kill the supreme leader, Iran will collapse. That means you know nothing about Iran at all. And I think, sadly, this is the reality. We know nothing about Iran, and we're not making any effort to learn anything about Iran. If we did, we'd understand that everything we're doing right now is counterproductive.
Ideas that people like Lindsey Graham, people like Ted Cruz, others who, around Bibi Netanyahu, the Smotriches, and the Ben-Gvirs, they clearly don't understand what they're up against in terms of this kind of ideology. And it just seems to me that they're wedded to it. Donald Trump keeps tweeting and aggravating, even when he's negotiating the MOUs, etc. Clearly, he hasn't understood that the more you threaten the Iranians, the more you want to pulverize them. They're kind of yearning for martyrdom. And now he's just managed to get the entire Iranian people to turn up every night in virtually every city to exactly because he keeps threatening them and they keep trying to bomb. So that's something that is a watch this space. And perhaps we'll deal with this in the next segment. So thank you so much for that fantastic analysis. Not an easy area to go and deal with. And as a military man, you've given it your personal take. So for those who are theologically pristine, well, write in, send us your comments and let us know. If Scott got it wrong, tell us, let us know. And if there's stuff that needs to be added to his manual of education, I'm sure that he'll read those comments and take them on board if they have value. Thank you once again, Scott Ritter. Thank you for watching. Do like, share, subscribe to Deep Dive Perspective as well. Goodbye.